Blog Talk Radio.
This is Cliff, your host. Today we are going to talk about ancient America with, I'm really excited to say, a really top researcher, Scott Walter, who is the host of Unearthed America, a History Channel program that airs quite regularly. My apologies if you dialed in a little earlier, and that program was on a time delayed system, so this is gonna run the full length, and anyhow, here you are, and away we go. Scott is a graduate. He graduated with a degree in geology and earth sciences from the University of Minnesota. He is a forensic geologist and works as a petrographer, and has done that since 1985. In 1990, he founded the American Petrographic Services and continues to serve as the president. He has been the principal petrographer in more than 7,000 material forensic investigations around the world, including the fire-damaged concrete from the Pentagon during following the attack of September 11th, 2001, 9/11. So, I think you'll really like this. And by the way, I want to let everybody know that I'd like to hear from you. I have an email address. It's cliff@earthancients.com. Let me know what you think of the show, if you like the guests, if you're enjoying the content, you know, and send me some suggestions. If you have suggestions, you know, let me know. Tell me what you like, what you don't like, what shows were your favorites, because I'm constantly looking for new and updated and really quality material. And I do speak, as you know, with a number of new and upcoming authors, as well as people who have been around for a long time. So here's the interview. It was recorded last Sunday on Father's Day. Scott is recording a new program based on his research that is going to be aired probably, I think he said in the winter, but I'll let him tell you about it. So enjoy. I'll come back on a little bit later. So today my guest is Scott Walter, the host of American Unearthed, and Scott's coming to us today from, I believe, Minnesota. Is that correct?
That's right.
Great. Hey, thanks for joining me today. It is Father's Day, so I don't know if you're a father, but happy Father's Day.
I am a father. I have two kids, a 25-year-old son and a 21-year-old daughter. It's hard to believe they're getting to be that old, but two great kids, and I've heard from both of them today, so that's nice.
Yeah, fantastic. Speaking of fathers, do you think the founding fathers of our country knew that there was an earlier history to our country before they came over here and founded the United States? I mean, your work deals with a lot of discovery around the Masons and their work. But do you think mm-hmm. that there's something to that possibility?
No question about it. I'm 100% convinced they, certain members of those founding fathers, Thomas Jefferson, I think there's no question, Washington, Franklin for sure. In fact, maybe there's a heck of a lot more, but did they know about earlier cultures that came here? Did they know about the Templars coming to this country prior to contact? I have no doubt in my mind they did.
Interesting. So it's possible that there's a lot of unwritten history that was known by people that came over and colonized our country. Maybe a historic notion of files that were lost somewhere, or just a general understanding that we just don't know about. Is that what you think may have been the case?
Well, I think that the knowledge of these earlier cultures has been known from the get-go right up to today. I mean, the Smithsonian Institute knows exactly what went on here because they initiated the mound excavation program and basically cleaned out any of the evidence that would have shed light on that. And I think they're sitting on a bunch of it in the archives in the bowels of that institution. I mean, mm-hmm. you know, the people say, well, how can you prove that? I say, well, you know, first of all, open them up and let's take a look. But the other thing is that the Bat Creek Stone really is their Achilles heel. That's one that got away from them and really exposes them for, quite frankly, being the frauds that they are when it comes to this unknown history. I mean, just last month, in the Smithsonian magazine, in the letters to, letters section, somebody from Owatonna, Minnesota said, what's the status of the research on the Kensington Runestone? And a person by the name of Bill Fitzhugh, an archaeologist who I know personally, chimed in and said the consensus of archaeologists and geologists is that it's a 19th century hoax. And I want to know what geologists he's talking about. The geologists all say that it's old. The reality is there is no archaeological aspect to the Kensington Runestone for archaeologists to chime in on. So why are they saying anything? I mean, this is a continuation of a policy they've had for a long time. And it's maddening. It's frustrating, but what do you do? You know, I mean, these people are basically lying, and they don't seem to care.
Well, it's amazing. American Unearthed is wildly popular and is going to, I guess it's going into its third season, right? Is that what?
We've done three seasons so far.
Okay.
And this would be the fourth season. But actually, the show that I'm working on right now is not America Unearthed. And I haven't been given permission to talk about the show, the new show yet, but all I can tell you is it's going to be really, really good. It's in a similar vein of what we've been working on. And stay tuned, because when I get a chance to talk about it, I'll be excited to tell you. But it's going to be good. So
looking forward to it. You know, you brought up a good point. We've had a number of Orthodox scientists on our program, Earth Ancients, here. And it seems like there's a general consensus in the academic sciences that there's certain knowledge that just is not ready to be divulged, or because it changes so much of written history, it's either problematic, or there's some kind of underlining law or rule that you don't divulge it. As an example, we had Dr. Robert Schock, who's a geologist who
I know Robert Schock.
Oh, very good. So you know his work on the Sphinx. So
yeah, I sure do.
Why are American scientists so unwilling to take this information and look at it a little closer and say, wait a minute, we could have this wrong. We're just not sure, but we could have this wrong. And maybe given this evidence, this new evidence and its clarity, that maybe we need to take a look at our history and maybe rewrite it. What's the reason for that?
Well, you know, it's not a simple answer. It's a very complicated situation that you're talking about. And unfortunately, one of the biggest issues that revolves around all of this, and really it's a big part of just life in general, and I guess I would call it problems of the human condition. and if you think about it, it plays a bigger role in our lives than it probably should, but it's the way the world works. It's the way our lives are, and so it's something that you just have to deal with. And, you know, people, I think if they think about it, realize that that's absolutely true. It is what it is. And so, and it plays a big role in this. And you said something before that kind of struck me as a little bit awkward, and you didn't even realize what you said, but you said academic sciences. Well, mm-hmm. It depends on who you're talking about. If you're talking about hard science disciplines like geology, you know, chemistry, mathematics, and so on, you know, those are hard sciences where people are taught proper scientific method. If you're talking about the humanities disciplines, like mm-hmm. archaeology, anthropology, linguistics, history, these are not hard science disciplines. And I know archaeologists get pissed off when I say that.
It's true. Yeah, I would think so. Yeah.
Well, too bad. Yeah. If you want to be called a scientist, then start acting like it. Okay.
Yeah.
And what drives me crazy, and I'll give you one example, and I'm going to call somebody out, but I'm just repeating what he said. This is a fact. It's not my opinion. But our state archaeologist says his name is Scott Amphenson, and Scott's a nice guy. The trouble is when you start talking about things like the Kensington Runestone, he starts to go a little crazy. But he mm-hmm. says that the most commonly asked question when he gives lectures in our state is about the Kensington Runestone. And he says, and I quote, "I don't know anything about geology. I don't know anything about runes, but I think it's a hoax." Now, this is irresponsible. I mean, you've eliminated yourself. You've done it yourself. You don't know anything about geology. You don't know anything about runes, but yet you still feel compelled to offer an opinion. I mean, I can't get away with something like that in geology. I'm a licensed professional, and I'm held accountable for what I say. His is a government-appointed position. It's a political position. And for him to say something like that, I mean, I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I would say it's irresponsible, number one. And number two, he damns a whole body of research before he really looks at it and comes up with a clue.
Exactly. But the point is that he's not in a position to look at it from the get-go. What opinion would he give me about my geological work that I'm going to really – I don't care what he thinks. He doesn't know geology. I'm going to talk to a geologist. And the fact of the matter is, the first person to do an extensive study on the Kensington Runestone was a geologist, the first state geologist of Minnesota, somebody who is considered a giant in his field here in Minnesota and nationally back in the day. And the ironic thing is that back in 1911, he wrote the definitive volume on the history. The title of the book is called The History of the Aborigines of Minnesota. It's a definitive volume that every archaeologist in our state refers to this day. But yet, he can be this amazing guy that wrote the definitive volume on archaeology, but when it comes to geology, for some reason, the guy doesn't know what he's talking about. I mean, it's laughable. And,
yeah.
I mean, this is the kind of stuff that we're up against, and I've had enough of this. I mean, I'm tired of it, you know.
And I can imagine you as a trained geologist have a problem. I remember hearing Robert Schock having the same issue when he dated the Sphinx as significantly older, and here's a body of Egyptologists who have no understanding of geology saying, no, you're wrong because it's written that it was put together by Khufu or whoever.
This is what we say. How dare you challenge us with your science?
Exactly.
And I mean, this is the same thing I deal with all the time. And it's like, really? I mean, come on, you know? And then, then, you know, look, they can't attack the science. They can't attack my work. So what they do is say, oh, well, you're not an academic. You don't have the proper degrees. You're not this. You're not. I mean, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm a licensed professional in the state. I can be held accountable. You guys can't. I mean, especially a tenured professor. What accountability does he have?
Well, it's interesting you say that, because a lot of the people that I have on my show are trained professional engineers. And as an example, I've had a couple of engineers. O'Keefe is one who went to the Mayan Central down in Tikal and has made some amazing discoveries on the cement they used that apparently is much more sophisticated than anything we've ever developed, or the Romans. And even though he claims that these are discoveries that required advanced knowledge, advanced chemistry, he is poo-pooed and ignored by the local archaeologists because it's too radical a thought.
Well,
but basically what...
I have to say that the archaeologists, that discipline, they got some shoring up to do. Let's put it that way.
Yeah.
I mean, they are the first to attack anybody that even begins to possibly suggest that maybe they might not have it right. And what is absolutely confounding to me is they are more concerned with being right than getting the right answer. And that is just the complete opposite of the world that I come from. We absolutely have got to get it right every time. And if it means I have to change my opinion, which I've done only a few times, but I'll do it. Because when I took an oath, my first number one priority was the health, safety, and welfare of the public, and I take that damn seriously. And, you know, so when I say something, I have the evidence to support it, and it doesn't matter if I'm talking about a bridge that has the potential to fall or the work we did at the Pentagon after 9/11, which I find also interesting that I was selected. The government told me I was assigned to this project, and apparently I'm competent enough to do work there, but yet I can't look at a rock. I mean, seriously, it's like, think about it. It's like, really?
It's kind of strange. Well, I think
it is, but it's not just me. It's Robert Schock and it's others that dare to step into these other people's worlds that they apparently feel that they own, and it's really confusing. Mm-hmm.
Let's talk a little bit about some of your personal interests. You are really focused on the Templar Knights. It's a big part of your research. And you have identified the hooked X symbol as a fairly major symbol. Can you tell us a little bit about why that symbol is so important and what you've discovered in the Americas regarding that symbol?
Well, I have to be upfront and say that one of the most important pieces of evidence that ties this that really goes to the very heart of the Hooked X, its meaning, its relevance, why it's connected to the Templars and other groups, I can't tell you about yet because it hasn't been published.
Okay.
But I can tell you it has something to do with Jerusalem. And, you know, this really goes to, well, it goes back to how I started this whole journey was with the runestone. And, you know, the long and the short of it is the geology told me it was real. Therefore, logic demands that if it's real, that everything in that inscription has to have a medieval explanation. That's just a fact, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, if it's medieval, then, and it was made then the knowledge to put the stuff on the stone had to have existed. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. I just want to be sure. I mean, jump in if you think I'm going off the rails. Well,
no.
Based on that, then the language, the runes, the dialect, the grammar all had to be there. I took 5 trips to Sweden, and I found everything with the help of a couple of linguists. So that, you know, that was pretty straightforward. And I knew that, you know, if you sit there and you say that it's a hoax, Well, then you're never going to get out of your chair and do anything. I came from a completely different perspective because of the geology. And the language runes and the dialect pointed to an island in the Baltic Sea, which was Gotland. And the only clergy, and you have to remember back in those days, the only person that could have carved an inscription of that complexity and length had to have been a member of the clergy, because the common people weren't educated. And the only clergy that we had in the areas, not just on Gotland, but in southern Sweden as well, the only clergy we had were the Cistercians. Well, who are they? And then I started researching them, and I found out that St. Bernard de Clairvaux wrote the charter for the Knights Templar in 1128, which was based on the charter of the Cistercians. So the evidence trail led me directly to the Knights Templar. This wasn't, you know, the Da Vinci Code or some pipe dream that I thought was going to be cool. The evidence trail took me right to them. And so that's how I got there. And as that was all happening, the final thing that had yet to be solved on the runestone was this mysterious hooked X symbol that was being used for the A sound in the inscription. And again, logic said there has to be an explanation. So in the end, what I have determined, my speculation is, and it's not really speculation, because one of the things that we found on the in Sweden was that the second line on the stone is not journey of discovery. It's actually journey of acquisition or taking up land. So suddenly the context of the message changed. It was a land claim. So I began looking at it from that context, and it turns out it's right on the continental divide, north-south continental divide of North America. And by placing a land claim stone in the ground, you could lay claim to the entire river system and all the land associated with it. And that was the practice of the French and the Dutch at that time. And funny, the Cistercians and the Templars were founded in France. So you have what we call consistencies, where all the data is lining up and telling a consistent and cohesive story. And, I mean, that's one of the questions and one of the arguments against the stone for a long time. Well, why would they come all the way to the middle of the continent? That doesn't make any sense. Well, now it does. It has to make sense if this thing is real, because here it is. It's a Minnesota rock. That was another thing that we concluded. They came here, they selected a rock, they split it down to this 2-to-1 ratio, and that's another thing that when you start to understand the Cistercians and the Templars, that symbolism and geometry and ratios are very important, and we have them within this inscription. And the more of this stuff that you start adding on to the database, the more and more it becomes ridiculous to claim that it's a hoax and that this farmer could have come up with all this. I mean, it's nonsense.
Yeah.
But yet, why is it? Why is it that these supposedly smart people, these archaeologists and historians, refuse to even consider it? It's not that they don't believe it. They don't want to even touch it. Because it's going to somehow change a paradigm that they bought into, and it's apparently their religion. I mean, I don't know what else to call it.
Academic religion. Yeah, I hear you. I totally hear you.
Yeah, so anyway, but that's where it started, and basically what I've figured out is that the hooked X is the unique symbol, and actually on the runestone what it represents is a unique mark that I think their original plan was, if they had to come back and prove this land claim, that they would have been the only ones to be able to prove that they were the ones that put that claim down because of the hooked X. Mm-hmm. And later on, because if you think about it, after the put down in 1362, they sure as hell wouldn't have made the claim in honor of the king, any king, a monarch, and certainly not the Pope or the Vatican. So... Mm-hmm. Who is the claim for? Well, it was for them.
Interesting.
So the hooked X serves as that unique mark, but it's more than that. It's a very important symbol that represents their true ideology of monotheistic dualism, which is an ancient faith that they were trying to restore, and I think that's part of the reason that they were put down. Of course, historians don't know about that, so they talk about the money and Philip the Fair and all of that, but there's more to this story. I mean, it just hasn't all come out yet.
Do you think that they had, well, they obviously must have had some knowledge of the Americas to come across the Atlantic in that time frame. What's your guess in, as to how they would have known about uncharted area like that? Who, what information would they have gotten to get across the Atlantic to find America?
Well, the information probably would have come from under the Temple Mount when they were in Jerusalem and mounted the First Crusade and dug under the temple. And according to sources I've seen, they part of what they recovered was ancient knowledge of navigation, maps, sources of wealth, and maps how to get over here. And other parts of the world. I mean, that's the thing that I think people forget. They didn't just come to America. They went all over the world. And but America was unique and was special. They formed a strategic alliance with Native Americans over here because they shared a similar ideology. And when you talk about the church coming over here and, you know, the Puritans and the Quakers and all these others that came during the time of contact, they didn't get along with the natives because their ideology was completely different. So, of course, they killed them and took the land. But when the Templars came over, it was different. They knew that to have success on a continent that probably had at least 30 million, some people say as many as 100 million people living here, which really gives the whole notion of Christopher Columbus, who never set foot on the continent but yet discovered this new land that had at least 30 million people living on it, which is just ridiculous. But the point is that the Templars understood how to intermarry to form these strategic alliances and, you know, set the table for eventually the job that would be finished by Freemasons centuries later. And that's where you asked me right from the get-go, do I think the Founding Fathers, certain members of the Founding Fathers knew about the earlier Templars and other cultures that had been here thousands of years earlier? Of course they did.
It's interesting. It's funny because everyone's always curious about the Masons and why there's so much secrecy. Well, if you have an advanced knowledge, you're probably going to be burned at the stake. So,
well, at the time when Freemasonry basically had its coming out party in 1717, I mean, it certainly existed before that, but their official position is, no, we didn't. Well, that's BS, and they know it too, but, you know, I mean, come on. I mean, it's silly, but no, I mean, they, and you know, when I say this, you have to be careful how you couch this, because not all Freemasons were in on the secret. In fact, a very, very select few would have been in on the secrets. And I know enough about Freemasonry that when a person goes through and becomes a Mason, a master Mason, at that point, that's when the fun really starts. So there are side orders and other groups that certain people will be invited into or can petition to be part of. And I mean, I don't understand how the details of how it works, but I know that these side orders exist and they know a lot more than the everyday Freemason. So we're not talking about every guy who's a Mason is in on the secrets. In fact, a very, very select few, probably less than 1%, know what's really, you know, really going on within the order.
It's interesting. I was reading on your blog that I think it was like a week ago, you and your wife, Janet, were invited to it's West Fall, Massachusetts for the unveiling of a special monument. And it's actually a place where a fallen Templar knight was laid. I guess it's the Gunn clan who traveled they traveled over there in 1398. And I was looking at your blog, and actually the sculpture is beautiful of this fallen knight. On his I guess down by the sword is the X, is the cross.
It's the hooked X, yeah.
Yeah. What's significant about that place? What can you tell us?
Well, here's the thing. I mean, you have to be careful, and you know, it's funny, the last few days we've had quite a bit of activity, especially even today already. a lot of activity on my blog about the Westford Knight. And, you know, it's been a little bit of a confusing site, and some of the skeptics have gone on there trying to muddy the waters further. But the reality is this. There is it's a bedrock outcrop that has been glacially striated by glaciers that were there 12 to 15,000 years ago. I don't know the details of the glaciology there, but it scratched the bedrock. You've got these parallel scratches on the surface of the rock, and somebody in the past took advantage of a couple of deep grooves that are about the width of a sword blade and added a guard and a hilt on a handle onto this sword. And you can see some peck marks where about the middle of the blade, it looks like it's got a crack or a break in it, which is symbolic of a fallen Templar knight. Now, only last year, not even a year ago, they were cleaning it in preparation for building this shelter, which was the number one thing that this was designed for. This ceremony was for unveiling a shelter. But when they were cleaning it off, they found a hooked X with two dots carved kind of in the lower left-hand side relative to the sword if you align it vertically. And it almost looks like they like somebody signed a painting or a drawing. It's amazing. And when I first heard about it, I'm like, no way. And I went out there. I've been out there and looked at it now. I've seen it three times now in the last year. And there it is. I mean, it sure looks like a hooked X to me. The only reason it's a little questionable is because it's the weathering is very advanced. It's about the same as the sword. Now, many people in the past have claimed that there's an effigy of a knight there. And I've looked at this thing probably a half dozen times prior to this year, and there's no knight there, but they have a sword. And so what's happened is people have made the claim that there's more there than there really is. In fact, they've gone so far as to say that there's symbols on there that tell them that the shield has the coat of arms of the Gun Clan. And that's just not there. Now, yeah. You know, the whole legend of Prince Henry Sinclair coming in 1398, there's a lot of reason to suggest that that's true, but it hasn't been definitively proven. And it's I guess it is pretty well established that the Gun Clan was on that ship, and he was very close to Prince Henry Sinclair, and they suggest that because they think that effigy of the Gun Clan is on the shield, that it was a gun that died, and that sword was carved in honor of a gun. We don't know that. That is not something that I would ever say, and I don't think anybody should say. It's possible, but do we have any direct evidence? No. But it could be, absolutely could be, symbolic of a fallen knight, certainly dating back, could very well date back 600 or so years when I believe that the Templars were here. And most of the Templar graves that I've seen when I've been over in Europe on the grave slabs, it's nothing more than a sword. So you have that. And now with the hooked X being with it in association, and my research showing that the only places I've ever found the hooked X is associated with Freemasonry and the Knights Templar, well, now this adds a little credibility to that story, but it still doesn't get us to Prince Henry and the Gun Clan, not yet.
Is there anybody else that has looked at that in Westford and actually made some analysis of these carvings, these petroglyphs?
Yeah, I don't think anybody has done as much work as I have, but there was a geologist that weighed in, I think, in the 90s. I think he was a former state geologist, and he said that this is definitely an effigy of a sword, and it's highly weathered, and it's old, and that it is an important historic feature in Westford, and I don't know if he said it should be preserved and protected, but he did say it was important, and I wholeheartedly agree. So the consensus, at least among two geologists that have looked at it, that know a little something about the weathering of man-made surfaces, that this is man-made, it's a sword, it's old, and it should be preserved and protected until more technology comes in the future to give us more information. I don't know how anybody, whether you believe or not believe, can argue with that philosophy. I just don't, I don't see how you can do it.
Well, it's a big enough deal for the locals to put together a significantly expensive memorial to that. I mean, so, the people in that area feel that it's a real deal. So,
and they should be commended for putting their money and their time and effort where their mouth is. And a lot of people pay lip service to these types of things, but nothing ever seems to get done. So what I said when I was there, and that's the reason I went there, is I wanted to show my support to a community that stepped up and did something to preserve a cultural resource that absolutely still has many questions yet to be answered about it, but there's enough good things there that they believe it should be protected and preserved for future generations because it could represent a critically important piece of our history. And I just don't know how anybody can argue with that, that philosophy. Bravo to them.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question, and you repeat this in your book. You say, you use this kind of language. You say, until newer technology can be developed, this is as far as we can take it. This is what we know based on our current understanding of science. When you say future technology, are you talking about some of the scanning technology that's in its infancy that can determine the depth of a cut in a stone and rock, perhaps weathering analysis that would reveal more specifics on dating? Is that what you're referring to when you say technology?
Well, I'm talking about all of it. I'm talking about the technologies that we are aware of that are in their infancies and some of the technologies that we probably, we haven't been developed yet. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, anything and everything technology-wise is on the table. And, I've tried to develop some of the laboratory techniques and field techniques that we use on concrete in the laboratory to try to get some information about the age of some of these man-made inscriptions. And I have to say, it's extremely difficult. And, in some cases, we've been able to go quite far and reach a definitive conclusion. In the case of the Runestone, the Back Creek Stone, Tucson Lead artifacts, Spirit Pond, and some others. But there are a lot of artifacts that we just can't draw a definitive conclusion yet, like the Westford sword and the Hooked X there. But there's enough there that it looks really promising. And I think that if we just wait a little bit, I'm sure the way technology advances so quickly that some young geologist is going to come along and he'll be able to tell us exactly how old it is. I'm confident that'll happen, hopefully in my lifetime.
Some kind of a scanning technology that can determine the signature of the cut and maybe become so sensitive it picks up on minute particles of the instrument that was used for cutting or something,
I hear you.
Who knows?
Actually, a lot of that, technology exists today. I have some of that technology where we can absolutely quantify and measure and map and replicate digitally the depths of the cuts, the widths of the cuts, the profile of the surface, and so on, and learn more about the weathering profile, the types of tools that were used, force of the cut, and all those kinds of things. But, we can always do better. We're really just getting started with this, and it's exciting, and it's fun. And, the one thing that I will say is, look, I have a personal thoughts on these things, and I'm pulling for them. I mean, would I like this stuff to be Knights Templar? Of course I would. But on the other hand, you know, the science drives the bus. I mean, I have the personal right. side that can say what I would love it to be, but there's the scientist in me that absolutely cuts no corners and does things the way that they have to be done. And I think sometimes people get confused and think that the lines get blurred, but the reality is they don't. And I have made many calls where I said, this is not old. This is modern. And believe me, nobody would want it to be old more than me in some of these cases, but
yeah.
If the science says no, then the answer is no.
Isn't there a technique, and I'm not 100% sure about this, but where you can pour and make a mold of a petroglyph and determine certain characteristics of it that would date it? Or is that more still kind of fantasy now? Where you have
I'm not aware of anything like that.
Okay.
You know, the type of science that I've been using is what I call relative age dating. Mm-hmm. And what it's, and I'll give you a real simple example. Let's say we have an unknown inscription that dates back to when an area was settled. You know, the first settlers said, well, that thing was here when we got here. And let's say somebody, and I've seen this many times, somebody in the 1800s, say 1850, carves their initials into the rock nearby and dates it. We can use that as a control to say, well, this has been weathering for 150 years in the same environment, same exposure conditions, everything else is that inscription over there that we don't know anything about. And clearly we can see that the weathering of this known date is much less advanced than that over there. Now, all we can say at that point is that unknown is older than this one here. But in many cases, that might be enough to say, hey, look, there was nobody here. And the natives didn't do it. So yeah. It's not likely that they knew, you know, runes, or they knew Old Swedish or Ogham or whatever the case may be. So now suddenly you have a pretty darn compelling argument that what you have is old, even though we don't have a number on that date. But if it's 2, 3, 4, 10 times more weathered than something else, that starts to push it back pretty far. And that's the kind of thing that I've been able to do in some cases with great success, and in other cases, I can't make heads or tails of it. You know, it's just every situation is different. You have to take every situation on a case-by-case basis.
Interesting. You know, in your home state of Minnesota is perhaps one of the most amazing artifacts, which is the Kensington Runestone. Mm-hmm. And I've been educating myself a little bit about it, and it was found by a farmer in 1898.
Correct.
And determined to have some glyphs and carvings in it. And it's gotten so much press as being a fake, but it's really a significant stone. Can you tell us just a little bit about this and why the stone and why it's so important?
Well, first of all, if I go back and I use my forensic science background, I've been doing autopsies on concrete and rock, performing forensic studies on inorganic materials for 30 years. I understand the process. I don't know, not too many people that have done more than I have. And I'm not bragging, it's just the way it is. And,
sure.
And when it came to the runestone, it was pretty clear to me. And remember, I didn't have a background at all in this stone when it first came to my lab. I'd never heard of it. I didn't know anything about it. Quite frankly, I didn't really care that much because, you know, I was coming off of, I get a lot of interesting projects in my lab, and this was interesting, but not any more than some of the other things I work on. And so I was completely neutral. I had no bias at all. And it became pretty clear early on that I was not finding any evidence that it was modern. I was finding evidence that it was old. And eventually I wrote a report and I said that it was old, therefore it must be genuine. And then I found out that the first state geologist of Minnesota, Newton Winchell, had studied the stone in 1909 and 1910. And that was after I had reached my conclusion. And I got a little nervous because I know who Winchell is. He's a giant in Minnesota geology. He's the man. And I didn't know what his conclusion was at first, and then I got a little nervous. I said, oh, God, if he had a different conclusion, I'm in trouble. And I read his report, and I saw his conclusion. He said it was absolutely genuine. And it's funny because there are skeptics now that'll say, oh, well, he tentatively reached that conclusion. That's a bunch of BS. He was emphatic. He said it must be accepted as a genuine record of exploration in Minnesota at the date stated in the inscription. Absolutely emphatic. And, of course, they try to twist things around to make it sound like, you know, to muddy the waters. And it's just irresponsible because these people have an agenda. And yeah, their agenda is to put this down. But here's the facts, okay? The fact is this, and a lot of people don't think about it like this, but you tell me, Cliff, if this doesn't make sense to you, okay? The work that we've done and the work of many other people, going all the way back to Winchell, who, by the way, is the guy that deserves credit for solving the Kensington runestone 100 years ago, not me, him. If we have voluminous evidence in multiple disciplines, geology, language, runes, dialect, grammar, history, that are all consistent with this being a genuine medieval artifact, then how can there possibly be evidence to support the contrary? In other words, what evidence, factual evidence, could possibly exist to prove it's a hoax if it's genuine? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, yeah, go ahead.
The answer is zero. And the truth is, there is no evidence to support it being a hoax. And I have, and I'll say it again, I will challenge anyone in the world to a mock trial, to sit down with a lawyer and prepare an argument that this is a hoax, realizing that a judge, a jury, an arbitrator will not allow speculation, opinion, unsupported opinion, speculation, rumor, and innuendo, because when you distill it all down, when you drill down to every accusation that's ever been made about the runestone being a hoax, there's no facts there, none. And the things that people have claimed, like Olaf Ullmann was a Freemason or Olaf Ullmann was a stonemason, neither one is true. He was not. Yeah. He was a carpenter, and he was not a Freemason. So good luck. You want to challenge me? I guarantee you, when you sit down and you start digging into the facts and what you are going to get up in front of I'd love to do it in a public mock trial, but yeah, you're going to get up and make this argument. This is why nobody challenges me, because it's never going to happen, because they have no case, because there are no facts to support a conclusion. There can't possibly be any facts to support. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Oh, it totally does. But more to the point, not only is this a very old effigy, but it's a marker, isn't it? A marker that is almost like it talks about finding people that were dead, I think. But also,
What it says is, when we came home, found 10 men red with blood and death. Now, that phrase, in medieval times, which if 1362 is the proper time period, which I don't know why it wouldn't be, everything is consistent with that. This was shortly after the plague had ravaged not just Europe, but people forget this was a worldwide phenomena. And red with blood and death is often how people stricken with plague were described. And,
interesting.
So many people for the last 117 years now have said, well, they were killed by the natives. It doesn't say that, okay? And in fact, the evidence and the research that I've done suggests, and I think simple logic would tell you that there's no way in hell that these guys are going to get anywhere near Minnesota unless the natives let them. And this is what the natives have told me. So they're fighting their way to Kensington. They were traveling with the natives. And so the idea that there was this massacre by the natives is probably BS. And so a lot of people have run off with that story idea. And, you know, if you don't have a strong foundation for a thesis, you're dead. And that one I just think is a non-starter. And I think it could be plague. The other thing that people have to understand, we're dealing with the Knights Templar, who were experts in allegory and code. And so what you think it says may not be the real message. It may be code for something else. And in fact, I think that's probably the case.
But, I mean, do you find, and there's another, there's a couple of other authors that have that spoken about landmarkers like the Kensington Runestone. Do you think there's elements on there that are cipher for this is a plot, this means that this is a claim by the Knights of Templar, or what? What do you say?
Yeah, absolutely. No doubt about it. It says this is a land claim, acquisition, business, or taking up land. Goths. Goths are people from the southern Baltic region, southern Sweden, Denmark, Baltic region, and that's the Templars had a heavy presence there. And it says 22 Norman, N-O-R-R-M-E-N. Now, this has been translated as Norwegians, but maybe it's just exactly what it says, Norman, as in Norman French, people from the Norman region of Europe, which would be Templar, wouldn't it?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah. Have we found or have you discovered any other runestones that have similar markings? I know we're going to get to Rhode Island here in a minute to discuss some standing things. Well, but other than the standing effigies, is there anything that's similar to Kensington that is similar?
Well, you've got the three Spirit Pond runestones that all have the hooked X on them, and features that are directly tie them to the Knights Templar. You've got the Narragansett runestone in Narragansett Bay in Rhode Island, which is a mixture of runic characters from different time periods and different what they call futharks, so the runic alphabet. The Scandinavian scholars have documented this, but what they don't know is that the Cistercians and the Templars often mixed alphabets, and they would use unique alphabets that would take characters from multiple alphabets and create their own unique coded alphabet. So when they look at it and it doesn't seem to make sense to them, is exactly what the Templars intended. And in fact, unless you know the code, good luck. And that's part of what's going on in the runestone. I mean, there's a narrative there that they can read, but there's a lot more going on there than even the experts understand. And the problem with these guys is that they're so arrogant, most of them, is that it's their way or the highway, and they're not even open to listening to people like me that have had a lot of experience dealing with these other coded languages and coded alphabets. And I'm certainly not an expert, but I think I could help them. But you can't help somebody that doesn't want to be helped.
Has there been any established setting for how the Kensington runestone was placed? Was it placed like on a foundation of rocks? How was it placed to be viewed? Do you know?
It wasn't placed to be viewed. It was buried. First of all, who's going to read it? The natives? They can't read it. And they were there when it was put down. They were with them. They knew what they were doing, and they buried it. And then they set up a series of triangulation using stone holes carved in rocks so that a returning party could find it. And we've shown that there is a triangulation of stone holes, mysterious rounded triangular holes that you can only make by pounding out with a straight chisel and hammer, and they triangulate exactly where the runestone was found. So it wasn't set up, nor would it make sense to set up. It was buried as a land claim to be dug up later, just like the lead plaques that Lavrandre buried claiming land for France that I believe was designed to replace the older Templar land claims that were nonspecific, and then the French came in and put in these specific land claims to the French king, claiming ownership because politics and world history had changed. And the Hooked X claim to this unique group of people was no longer necessary. It became obsolete, and of course the Founding Fathers, funny, they just happened to purchase the same land, or virtually the same land, that the La Vérendrye plaques claim for the Louisiana Purchase. Mm-hmm. The Runestone makes the same claim. And we bought this land from, oh, the French. Funny how that works. Do you think there's a connection there? I do.
That's interesting.
Think about that.
Yeah.
Is that a coincidence? Maybe. No. I don't think so.
No. Not if these guys are dabbling in masonry and masonry.
Well, these secret societies were meeting all the time. The Lodge of Nine Sisters is a highly secretive secret society in France that Thomas Jefferson's on their rolls, Ben Franklin's on their rolls, and other Freemasons, Voltaire is on there. And is it possible that they received information in these French secret societies about these earlier land claims and probably about the Templar land? Of course they did. I mean, if you don't think that they could transfer information for hundreds of years, if not thousands of years, you're kidding yourself. This is standard practice for these guys, I'm telling you.
Yeah. Very bright individuals, too. Hey, is there some importance with Inspirational Peak in Minnesota and the Knights and Templar? Is there something unique about that area?
Well, it's the third highest point in Minnesota. And, you know, these guys were expert navigators, and they were able to travel across land. And they used the stars, the moon, the planets, the sun to navigate. Would they have been up at Inspiration Point? I don't know that for sure, but I'd be shocked if they weren't. So I do think that probably plays a role in this story, but the reality is I don't have enough information to say with certainty, other than I understand how these people operated, and a high vantage point like that. I mean, any explorer, not just the Templars. I mean, that's Exploration 101, isn't it?
Exactly, yeah. Amazing. Let's go to East Coast, and this is something that I'm very curious about your take on it. The Newport Tower in Rhode Island. Now, I've actually studied it a little bit. It's been carbon dated to be over 500 years old, which is a significant point right there. But what else is unique about that the tower? You actually show it in your book that there's towers of similar design throughout Europe. So that's a big point right there.
Well, I mean, the architecture is you know, one of the first things that you have to look at. And the octagonal, you know, eight columns with a round cylinder on top is absolutely found in Knights Templar and Cistercian architecture in their monasteries and in their churches. So it's not totally unique there, but it is very unique that architecture is almost spot on. Now, again, coincidence? No, it's just another factual piece of data that you put in with everything else. And remember, from a scientific standpoint, a truly scientific standpoint, the way that you can vet out a theory is with evidence that is consistent. And if you have a piece of data that doesn't fit, you're not there yet. But this thesis hangs together so well, in my mind, it's conclusive. And the architecture of the tower is just one of them. So, you know, there are some anomalies that are out there. But when you take a closer look at them, it seems to me that you find, funny, Freemasonry seems to be involved when you're talking about a more modern structure. But, you know, the thing about the Newport Tower, and really I could go on for hours about that structure, but I think one of the important things that you need to recognize is that there are many, many features that, I mean, starting with just the structural makeup of the tower itself. I mean, I work in the engineering field, in the construction industry, And I have been asked to give technical presentations about various aspects of the work I do. And a couple of times I've gone up in front of structural engineers. And what I've done is I've told them nothing. And I wasn't there to talk about, you know, this historical stuff. I was there to talk about petrography, about the work that we do in our industry. And just for fun, before I even started, I said, hey, guys and gals, before we get started, I just want your opinion on something. And then I flash up a picture of the tower, and maybe one person out of 50 people had any idea what it was. The rest had no clue what it was. And I just asked them a simple question. Would a structure like this serve structurally as a windmill? And the room, there was like that awkward little laugh. Like, are you kidding? And I said, what does that mean? Well, no, it couldn't serve as a windmill because of this, this, and this. The lateral wind forces from the sails would cause it to tear itself apart. So the notion that this is a windmill to a structural engineer is ridiculous. And so when you really start to examine it, and then you start to look at the astronomical alignments that are in this tower, the illumination event that happens to take place, funny, only on the winter solstice. And there are probably many more astronomical alignments in this tower that we haven't figured out yet. There's Venus alignments in this tower. There's an alignment out to Kensington. There are Masonic features within the tower. The Mark Master Mason's Keystone is sitting on the outside of the tower in one of the archways. I mean, all these things come together, and it points to one group, the Templars. I mean, it's like it's a layup in my mind.
Mm-hmm. No, I think it's fascinating because in your book you actually show photographs of paintings that were made in the early 1800s of the landscape, right. And here's the tower, you know. So it's been there.
It looks the same back then as it does today. I mean, exactly. You know, you can even see the plaster on the inside of some of the columns. It has the exact same pattern over 200 years ago that it does today, which means nothing really has changed that much. And, you know, it takes time for it to get in that ruined state. But yet there are remnants of plaster on the outside stones that tells you that the entire tower was plastered and was white and would have been a glowing beacon in the sun. And again, when you talk about navigation and lookouts, it would have been absolutely used for navigation down in Narragansett Bay, which is the most perfect natural harbor on the whole East Coast. It's just the most amazing place. And, you know, it's interesting. When I was out at the Westford Night ceremony, a day before the ceremony, we went to the Newport Tower. And a local Native American Wampanoag native was asked questions by a group of people. And one of the things, and I've got this, I recorded it. I'd never met this guy before, and I asked him some questions about the tower, and I said, well, what about this idea that this was built as a windmill by John Dee in the late 1500s during the Elizabethan period? And he said, he just chuckled, and he said, there's no way that those people who were intolerant of natives would have built that tower. And I said, why not? He said, because we would have killed them. He said, there's no way you're gonna take the time and the energy and the resources on our land to build something like that unless you had our permission. He just was laughing. He's like, are you kidding me? And so then I asked him flat out. I said, okay, well, then you tell me who built this tower. And he goes, well, he said, our oral traditions say the people that built this tower had fiery red hair. And then I said, who is that to you? He just put his hands up and he said, the Templars, obviously. Wow. And I said, is it because they would have sought your permission? He said, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I knew the answer before I asked the question. Yeah. But this was a native. 11 generations, he can trace his ancestry back to to the
Has anyone done any ground penetrating radar around that the tower to see if there's any other structures that it may be sitting on, or do we know anything more about it?
Yes and no. There has been archaeology done outside of the sidewalk, and there's been archaeology done inside the footprint of the perimeter. Now, but where they have not dug is under the sidewalk, which is where they would find the remnants of the ambulatory that was certainly around that tower, just like it's around all the other Templar structures, churches that are built with the octagonal two-story round cylinder architecture. But they've never dug under there. And I've been proposing this for a long time. There was a salvage archaeological dig done several years ago when they replaced the sidewalk, and they found remnants of two of the post holes exactly 16 feet off center from two of the columns. I'm confident if they dug underneath the sidewalk, they'd probably find the other six. And, you know, the other thing you got to keep in mind is people say, well, what about inside the footprint back in the 40s or 50s, whenever it was that they did the dig there down to bedrock? Well, you have to understand, this was also a church. This was a religious house as well as an observatory. And people didn't crap and leave their garbage where they prayed. So the fact that it's pristine archaeological site within the footprint of the tower doesn't surprise me at all.
Yeah, it's a fascinating structure. It's one of those buildings that really needs to be looked at a little closer. And it's funny that they
with an open mind.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. As to its potential. I have to ask you this, and with all your research, I've had a number of different authors on that talk about ancient copper mines that are hundreds of thousands of years old in America, evidence of other peoples from Asia in America. If you were to put a date, how far back in time would you say there were significant settlements from sophisticated societies in America?
Well, I really can't say for sure, but I do know that there have been some carbon dates obtained from wood that was used to block up and lift out large natural float pieces of copper in the UP and on Isle Royale. And there was one that they never got out that was on blocks of wood. And if I recall right, I think they got dates that went back as far as 6,000 to 8,000 years ago. So that would be about as far as I could say. But, you know, you have to understand, the largest natural and purest copper reserves found anywhere in the world are in the Great Lakes region, in Lake Superior region. We're talking 99.9% pure copper. And it was just laying all around after the glaciers melted back. I mean, it was literally, you just go and pick it up off the ground. And back in ancient times, I've heard people say that copper was more valuable than gold and silver because you could do so much with it. Plus, it had conductive properties. So, you know, good news like that, word gets around. And so, you know, if you could come to a place where you could literally just pick it up off the ground and throw it in your boats, and you have to understand, if you go back 8,000 to 10,000, or, you know, 6,000 to 8,000 years ago, the waterways were a lot different back then. You also had isostatic rebound. The crust of the earth was lower, so there was more water for people to navigate to the Great Lakes region. And I think sometimes people forget about this. They forget about the geological aspects. And so, you know, I would say it's probably not hundreds of thousands, because you go back 15,000 years ago, now the ice is in the way, and you can walk across the ice, but I don't think you could mine much below it. But, you know, starting 10 to 12,000 years ago, as the ice melted back, suddenly you had these amazing reserves of natural copper laying around. I think people figured that out fairly quickly. So I think those are the realistic timelines that we're talking about.
I bring up the great age because your book, Akhenaten and the Founding Fathers, is interesting. And I think there's a quote or something where there's a claim, the realization that the Hooked X and an ideological threat is an ideological threat 3,800 years ago. I'm trying to figure out the connection with those two, and travels to the United States or the Americas. And so I guess the question I would have is what is the Akhenaten connection? Is it just the science, the energy behind exploration? What is that? That's fascinating.
Well, what you get into when you start talking about Akhenaten, who was the father of King Tut, is he was known as the heretic pharaoh. He was the one that tried to change the religion in Egypt from polytheistic dualism to monotheistic dualism. And in practicality, what he really did was change the ideology from venerating the setting sun in Egypt to venerating the rising sun. It was still the same deity. It's just a different philosophy and studying different, just a little bit different interpretation of how that whole thing worked. But what people don't understand is that Akhenaten didn't just wake up one day and go, oh, I think I'm going to do this. Akhenaten did it because something incredibly profound changed in the heavens. And what you have to remember is that if you were a member of the ancient Egyptian priesthood, and certainly the pharaoh, who had to go through the same education as all the viziers and the members of the priesthood had to go through. And keep in mind, we're talking about a 10 to 20 year process to learn the ancient mysteries, which included, probably most importantly, astronomy and the whole concept of how what's happening up in the heavens can be transposed and reflected down on Earth. And one of the things that they kept very close track of was something called the precession of the equinoxes, which is the 26,000-year-long cycle through which the 12 primary constellations, the 12 primary constellations of the zodiac in that belt that goes around the Earth that we keep very close track of, that's how long that takes, and it's because of the Earth's wobble. It's a very slow cycle that takes thousands of years. Now, it also happens annually, but that precession is very long. And if you take 26,000 divided by 12, you get around 2,160 years or so. And so each time a constellation that takes its position in the eastern sky just before sunset, when the sun rises through it, that makes it a sacred age, a sacred time, a sacred period that only lasts a little over, on average, about 2,000 years. But it depends on the size of the constellation. And the priesthood, the Egyptian priesthood, kept close track of this. And it was this precession that triggered the change in Akhenaten's ideology. When Taurus the Bull was the primary constellation in the eastern sky, then slowly descended and disappeared on the horizon just before sunset, and then the new constellation cycled in, which was Aries the Ram. So when you look at depictions of Akhenaten and King Tut, you see them holding the crook and the flail. The flail herds the bulls, or the followers of Taurus, the old religion, and the crook herds the rams, the sheep of Aries, which symbolized the new religion, and crossed on his chest represented his attempt to unite the two religions. Mm. And it failed. And because it failed, and of course Akhenaten's Amarna, his city, was destroyed, and effigies of him were destroyed or defaced because the old religion didn't like it. But people don't understand this whole precession of the equinoxes and its vital importance on the history of humanity. Now, the next cycle to change came relatively shortly after Akhenaten, about 1,350 years, because Aries is a relatively small constellation. It didn't last a long time. And then that constellation gave way to the next one, which was Pisces the fish. And that happened about, 2,000 years ago. And who was this important person in the world at that time? Oh, yeah, some guy named Jesus.
Yeah.
Who was, it says in the Bible, born of the Lamb of God. Well, what the hell does that mean? Well, if you follow the procession, it means he was born in the waning years of the age of Aries the Ram, born of the Lamb of God. And then he becomes the Fisher King, right? Now you know what that means. If you're a follower of Jesus, you're a follower of the fish. It has everything to do with astronomy and the precession of the equinoxes. So flash forward 2,000 years. And do you remember a couple, 3 years ago, the end of the Mayan calendar, the end of the world, and you didn't max out your credit card, did you?
God, no. I hang out with the Maya. I knew ahead of time that all the religious fervor craziness was just BS. So.
It was all BS. Because yeah. What happened, and what's fascinating about this, and what is profoundly important in mystical circles, is that we didn't just see the end of the reign of the Fisher King. And as Templar mystics and Native American shaman have told me, is that the reign of the Fisher King ends, and the truth about Jesus is to be revealed. And guess what? That's happening too, isn't it?
Mm.
But here's the thing. It's not just the end of the age of Pisces, the fish. It's the end of the 26,000-year-long cycle. That's what the end of the Mayan calendar is. But when one cycle ends, what happens? A new one begins,
yeah.
And so you and I and the people listening to this show have lived through one of the most profound moments in the history of our species, and nobody understands that. And what they also don't understand is that this was prophesized to be a time of profound change in the world. And guess what? It's already happening. I'll give you a piece of evidence. You heard of this guy named Pope Francis?
Oh, sure, yeah.
He's singing a different tune, isn't he?
Seems like it, yeah.
Not seems, he is. And the moment that he stepped on that balcony when he became Pope, he flashed a sign. And that day I said, this guy's going to be different. He's on the squad. He's going to be singing a different tune, and you're going to see some real change. And he's been making me look like a genius ever since. And the only reason I said that is because I believed what these mystical people were telling me about this whole thing, about the procession, because it's based in science. It's based in astronomy. And it's funny, but, you know, what happens in the heavens does have an impact on us down here. I mean, I will give you the moon and the tides and the menstrual cycles of women as one example. That's not an opinion. That's fact, okay? So are there other things that could be impacting us down here? Well, I've opened my mind to that possibility, and I think it's true. And what I'm hopeful for is that this new beginning, this new cycle, will trigger a new age of truth, of honesty, and of people starting to put aside the old ways, accept the science that we all embrace. I mean, don't you find it interesting that some people will take on seemingly hard to accept belief systems, and they will discard and say, well, science doesn't make sense. I believe this. But yet they're perfectly happy to drive their cars and live their lives on their cell phones and take advantage of that science, yet aspects of their lives, there's this hypocrisy. And, I mean, I'm not trying to criticize some people, but this is what we see. And so I think we have an opportunity here to see some real changes, but we have to embrace them because, let's face it, we got some real issues on this planet now, and if we don't change the way we do business, we're in big trouble.
Yeah.
And why exactly. not take this opportunity with the new cycle to look inward and understand where we've been, the truth about where we've been in our history, so that we can go forward in the future intelligently and make a better world for our kids, our grandkids, and the ones we'll never meet.
Yeah, exactly. One last question, and then I'm going to let you go because this has been a great interview. Do you believe that America is a sacred place because everyone kind of came over here and wanted to establish a new point of view? I mean, we all read about how the founding fathers were all, some of them were persecuted for religious beliefs, for mm-hmm. personal beliefs, but it seems to me that this place that we call America is special for more reasons than we understand.
No question about it. Absolutely. And it was well said. I mean, that was put very nicely. In fact, I gave a lecture not too long ago to a group of Freemasons, and I basically laid out all this stuff and some things I haven't said and I won't say publicly right now, but I will in the coming days. But I said to these guys, look, I said, it was your ideological ancestors who started the process 1,000 years ago of establishing what they called a new Jerusalem that we now call the United States. And it's a place where people can have, can say what they want, can believe what they want, can do what they want, and have these freedoms that you just don't have anywhere else in the world. Now, is this a perfect utopia? Of course not. That's why that unfinished pyramid on the back of the dollar bill is symbolic of staying vigilant, that our work is never done, that we always have to keep making ourselves and our country better. But I said, you know what, guys? I said, there also comes a time when you have to sit back and just pause for a moment and say, job well done. And I was talking about their ideological ancestors founding this country that you said is sacred for those very reasons. And I couldn't agree more. And they gave me a standing ovation because deep down, they knew I was right because they already knew it. So, yes, wonderful. We live in a very special, sacred place. And we should all understand and appreciate it and work towards keeping it special and doing our own little part. And if everybody did their part, I think the whole thing would be even better than it is now.
Fantastic. Hey, Scott, thank you for giving us the time and much continued success in what you do. I guess you're still doing the American Unearth and some other projects that you can't really mm-hmm. divulge, but obviously, there is a monstrous audience out there that's eating up what you're talking about, what you're doing, and really, really wants to get down. I was excited when I first learned that you were doing this program because we need to have more, you know, raw evidence about these discoveries and not just everything being poo-pooed because they don't fit within a certain paradigm. So continued success in your work and much appreciated.
Well, thank you. And, you know, I guess the only other thing I'd like to say is, you know, it's easy to criticize people for making mistakes, and certainly certain segments of academia have made some mistakes, but I've always believed it's never too late to right a wrong. And, you know, I want to work with these guys. I don't want to fight with them. I mean, fighting gets us nowhere. And, I mean, you have to be honest. You have to be upfront about what's going on. But at the end of the day, you know, you don't persecute your kids forever when they make mistakes. You help them. And you coach them up, and you help make them better. And you work together to solve problems, to move forward. And that's what I would like to do. So I do take lots of shots at them. They take shots at me. But you know what? It's like a football game, man. I'll knock heck out of you and try to take your head off. But after the game, I'll be the first to buy you a beer and tell you how great you were. I don't take it personally. I just, you know, it's a good game. You work hard, but we all have to go home to our families. And you know what I mean?
I think the old guard's dying off, and between you and me, we have a lot of young graduates in archaeology and anthropology that are very positive about the work, that are trying to change the old dogma, the old way things are viewed, and hopefully, as I think you said at the beginning of the show, in our lifetime we'll be able to see these changes and see these new ideas and more acceptance about discoveries that don't really follow traditional path or traditional structures. So,
hey, look, the fact is the young people are the future. I mean, that's a fact. And we need to teach them well. We need to, you know, teach them to be open-minded, to do good work, to work hard, and follow the evidence. And so that's why whenever young people contact me, I try to get back to them and encourage them, and regardless of what field it is. And you're right. I think we're already starting to see that change. But and that's why I think these shows are so great, and the fact that I have this opportunity to reach so many people. Because, look, the everyday person isn't stupid. I mean, they can sniff out BS quicker than anybody. And now that they're starting to be aware of it, they're saying, look, I get this. Why don't you? And I think with more of that, more people paying attention, we're going to get better outcomes in the long run. So I'm with you on that, man, totally.
Hey, I could talk to you for all day long, but unfortunately we're down to about an hour and a half. Thanks again. Hey, I want to ask you, do you have any new books coming out? Because you seem to be pretty prolific. You're right. You did mention that you had some things that you really couldn't talk about. Is that more for the TV show, or is that
no? Well, I'm hoping to do them on the TV show, but I'm actually working on a book right now with a guy named Charlie Pellegrino. Charles Pellegrino. If you look him up, you'll see this guy's done some incredible stuff, and he asked me to write a book with him. And some of the stuff we're going to reveal in this book is just going to be a mind bender, but it's but it's solid. I'm telling you, you're going to love it.
How can it be more mind bending than what you've already delivered, Scott? I mean, Jesus.
Well, that's true, we're not done. We're not done yet, man. We got more good stuff coming.
I guess you've unearthed a spaceship somewhere that you're going to tell us about. Is that that's?
I did not say that. Don't put those words in my mouth. I did not say it. I'm open-minded to the whole idea of extraterrestrials, but personally, I have not seen enough evidence to push me too far in that direction. But I remain open-minded. I ask other people to be open-minded, so I have to do the same.
Great. All right. Hey, listen, thanks again, and much continued success to you.
All right. Well, thank you for having me on. Let's do it again soon.
Okay. So that was Scott Walter from American Unearthed. And that was a real, real fun interview. And that guy is amazing. You know, I will say this, that after we did that recording, we were still on the phone, and he felt a little bad about how upset he had been with the various archaeologists he dealt with. But apparently in his home state, there's pretty much not a lot of open thinking. And it's not just in Minnesota. It's around our country where archaeologists are basically damning a lot of discoveries that show that there were earlier people here that not only established towns and civilizations, but left a lot of evidence of their stay here. So real fun, real great interview. We're going to have Scott back probably maybe before the end of the year, because he has a new program that is going to be launched. He mentioned a little bit, and it's going to be a new TV program on, I think it's, well, I can't say where it's going to be. I was told not to say anything about it. So anyhow, I hope you enjoyed that interview. I want to let you know that, again, if you're enjoying these programs, to let me know about it, send me an email, send it to Cliff, CLIFF @earthancients.com. Let me know what you think. And I really appreciate hearing from everyone or from you about this work. It does come to you free. I am developing some sponsors, but these will be sponsors that are probably in line with the work, probably publishers that I work with, because this does take a lot of time to do these programs, to do the research. And I want to expand these programs to make them even more significant. We now are heard on about 20 different networks around the world. So again, let me know. Send me an email, cliff@earthancients.com. Let me know what you think about the program. And, you know, if you have suggestions, what you liked, what you didn't like, I want to hear it. I don't care. If you don't like certain types of topics, tell me. It's the only way that I know that you're enjoying the show. So email me, cliff@earthancients.com. I want to remind you that next week's program is quite a rare opportunity to hear from an author who is one of the only writers on the lost world of Lemuria, known as Mu. And that's George Schwimmer, who wrote this book on Mu a few years ago. And it's a real eye-opener. And he does some fantastic research and presents some pretty startling evidence. I think you'll really like the program. So next week is July 4th. Story of Mu with George Schwimmer. I hope you'll join me. So have a great day. Thanks.